6 minutes after 10 o'clock, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. When you turn on the tap, you expect to get water. When you flush the toilet, you expect whatever was in there to go away. When you flip the light switch, you aren't surprised when the light comes on. When you stop at the gas station to fill up your vehicle's tank, you expect gas to be available. And when it rains, you assume that storm drains are carrying away the rainwater to someplace else. But have you ever stopped to think about all of the infrastructure that makes those things possible? Well, Scott Hewler has, and he's written a book about it. On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work, attempts to shed some light on how our world, our everyday world, actually happens. From storm sewers to cell phone towers, Scott takes a close look at the systems that shape our society. He's an award-winning radio journalist whose work has been heard on All Things Considered, Day to Day, Marketplace, and The Splendid Table, among other places. And he's authored 6 books, including this one. And he joins me this morning by phone. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Well, we live in the midst of a staggering amount of infrastructure that we mostly take for granted. Would that be a fair statement?
It's absolutely a fair statement. One of the greatest things that people like to say is never before have so many understood so little about so much.
You know, I don't know. Well, it's the public radio audience, so I'm going to guess that many of the people listening to this program have perhaps seen the History Channel's series "History of Us," their look at American history. And recently, I think it was last week, they had one of the features was on the rise of the city and the things that that contributed to that. For example, the development of electricity. That allowed cities to be awake at night, sanitation improvements and so forth that made it harder to catch a disease in these large areas. And then the development of the automobile, which led almost directly to urban sprawl. People could live farther and farther away from work. We've been adding technology through the 19th, 20th, and now into the 21st centuries. How did we get to this point? In your book, you use Raleigh, North Carolina, as your example, but give us kind of a set the trail for us here of how did we get to where we are now?
Well, you say that we've been adding technology since the 19th century. We've really been adding technology since we showed up, since we started hanging around together and discovered that agriculture would enable us to stay in one place. It's been infrastructure after infrastructure after infrastructure. Infrastructure really begins about 4,000 years ago in a place called Mohenjo-Daro in the Asian subcontinent, where they built their buildings out of earth, and they had this discouraging problem that when it rained, their buildings kind of washed away, because in the low places they would just dissolve in the water. And so they came up with this great idea. They started digging trenches, and then they lined those trenches with stone, and eventually they covered them with stone, and they had the world's first storm drain. Storm drain turns out to be a foundational piece of infrastructure, because if your buildings are falling down, you can't live there, right? And if you're living in a swamp, you're going to get diseases, your food's going to rot, you're going to get sick. It's just not going to work. But once you can drain where you are, suddenly you can live in a stable way. Well, and as sewer historians like to say, on day one it was a storm drain. On day two, it was a sanitary sewer, because people started throwing other unpleasant things in it when they realized you could just throw it in there and it would go away. And it's been taking steps ever since. We have done almost nothing in our water infrastructure that the Romans weren't doing. That their system of aqueducts, of course, we still marvel at when we look at them. And although most of them weren't those beautiful arch bridges that we think of when we think aqueduct, most of them just ran along or underneath the ground just like ours do. And they were not only using standard water treatment, but they were using quite advanced methods. They were putting almond oil in urns of water, because that would help coagulate the stuff floating in the water, the impurities, and it would drop to the bottom. That's basically chemical water treatment today. If you went to a water treatment plant, you'd see that happening pretty much. So it's been incremental step after incremental step after incremental step. And, of course, every now and then you have something like the collapse of the Roman Empire where everybody forgets what they're doing and we fall back into troubled times. And then you rediscover it and you work forward again. So I think that we've just been moving forward since the dawn of civilization, really.
Well, I guess to defend myself, things certainly have accelerated in the last, say, 150 years. Technology seems to multiply itself. It's sort of the growth has become, if not exponential, perhaps logarithmic would be a better word. One technology breeds another technology, even if they've got antecedents that go back several thousand years. We've made a lot of improvements in the way things work. The development of the Bessemer steel process, for example, made it possible to make cheap steel, and that made it possible to build skyscrapers. And then that made other things possible. But each one of these things has come at a cost, and there have been problems associated with them. And one of the problems, according to your book, is that we don't know how these things work, and that's something that we need to fix. One of the things that you bring up in your book is that a lot of the infrastructure that we have is almost literally falling down around our ears. I think one of the numbers that's quoted is several trillion dollars worth of work needs to be done to save it, according to civil engineers. So this is a huge problem. Why aren't we aware of this?
Well, I think we're not aware of it because we don't care to be aware of it. I'm sorry, that's a sort of dispiriting look at our national character, but In 1981, when American Ruins came out, which was the first book that sort of, it was the conversation-setting book about infrastructure, the authors of that report estimated that we were about $850 billion in arrear in our infrastructure investment over the course of, you know, that's how far behind we were and what we needed to do just to maintain our systems and keep up. And they looked at that and they said, that is an enormous crisis. And now, as you said, that was exactly right. The American Society of Civil Engineers currently estimates that it would take us about $2.2 trillion to get us back, just to get us even, just to get us out of the red, you know? And that's three times as much as the civil engineers thought it was 30 years ago, and we're only going in the wrong direction. Places like Europe, they usually put about 5% of their gross domestic product into infrastructure, maintenance, new stuff, advances. China puts 9%. The United States puts in 2.2 to 2.4% of our gross domestic product. People say that no politician ever stood at a ribbon cutting when you maintained a sewer pipe. But if you build something new, if you build a new building, that's something that you get reelected on, and that's what people point at all the time. A fabulous traffic engineer that I spoke with for this book, named Eric Lamb here in Raleigh, said, I asked him, when you're dealing with the tremendous problems we have on the roads, with, as you pointed out, sprawl and traffic and all of these, you know, pedestrian versus car versus bicycle versus public transportation, all of these different issues that we have to resolve, what are the things, I asked him, that are never out of your mind? And I thought he'd say, convenience versus safety, or pedestrian versus motorist, or asphalt versus country, or something like that. And he said, the two things that are never out of my mind are money and political will. And that's really person after person whom I spoke with for this book. And as you know, I started at my house and I traced every system away from my house. I turned on the tap and said, okay, if I climbed up that tap and started swimming upstream, where would I end up and how did that water get there? And I traced my way back through the treatment plants, through the distribution system to the lake, and from there literally to the Gulf of Mexico, where the water would evaporate from in the first place. How did that work? I traced all these systems, and so system after system, I talked to these engineers who are working 24 hours a day to keep us in fresh water, to keep our electricity running, to keep our cell phones working and our internet functioning, and they all said over and over, we face no technological challenges that we can't overcome. There's no problem that we can't resolve. Now, whether we're going to pay to resolve those problems, That's the big question, because they're all expensive and it's all difficult, and nobody wants to spend the money.
Yeah, and well, there you go. I mean, because now you're talking about taxes, and you know, we're already being told that we should be paying less taxes, and we've got people who want to make government small enough to drown it in a bathtub. Which doesn't bode well for getting a lot of big public projects done. You trace these systems. Let's talk about some of those things that we take for granted. For example, and some things when there is a change, people get really upset. In Raleigh, North Carolina, where you live, you had, when you first moved there, I think you mentioned that you had garbage pickup was twice weekly, and you put your trash in a designated spot in the. And the collectors would pick it up. And then, like a lot of places, they went to an automated system once a week with these big wheeled trash bins. And a lot of people got really unhappy when that happened. Talk about why that was and how that speaks to the overall thesis of your book.
Oh, that's a great point. That's an excellent point. That when I moved here, you're right, quality of life is what Raleigh sort of makes its name on. We were just named to yet another, like, best quality of life list, I think, in the last week or two. But when I moved here, twice weekly, people hanging off the back of garbage trucks would walk into your backyard and pick up your trash can and take the bags out and carry them away. You didn't have to do anything more than throw the trash in the trash can, and then you never had to give another moment's thought to your garbage. And they looked at the people running the solid waste system for the city of Raleigh, looked at it, and they said, well, we can save money on worker compensation for injuries. We can save money on missed work. We can save money by having fewer people doing the same job. If we shift to those trucks, they call them one-armed bandits, those awesome trucks that have that weird skeletal arm that springs out of the side of the truck and picks up the garbage can and then turns it over and dumps it like it's shaking salt on its head. I love watching those trucks work. And that's one driver driving that truck up and down a street. And it used to be a driver and either one or two people hanging off the back of the truck. So they're saving at least half their personnel costs, and they're saving in missed work days. And they did the math, and then they could pick up once a week because they had these enormous rolling trash bins. They did the math. They said, this is a money saver. This works. We're going to do this. The people, as you exactly say, went mad. The people thought that this was the end of civilization in Raleigh. And then the people got over it. And now everybody rolls their trash to the front of their lawn once a week, and they pick it up, and it's no problem. And the bins are so large that if you do happen to forget a week, chances are it'll hold 2 weeks of trash. So you can understand how they made their decision. It terrified everybody. Nobody likes change, but it seems to have worked really well. And now we're doing the same thing with our recycling. Raleigh has a great recycling program. People recycle to an enormous degree here. And instead of having those green carryable bins, they're going to shift to large rolling bins just like the trash trucks, and they'll pick it up every 2 weeks instead of every week. And your point, which is very good, that people resist change no matter what it is. There have been letters to the editor written by older people who say, how can I push this enormous bin? I'd much rather carry the smaller bin. Pushing a rolling bin is so much easier than picking up and carrying, you know, an 18-gallon hopper full of glass and aluminum, so it really and heavy sodden paper that's been sitting out there. So it's not even logical to resist that, and yet people like it just the way it is. Please don't change anything. That's one of the many political problems that people fight.
We are creatures of habit. We're talking about the book On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work, with Scott Hewler, who's the author of that book, talking about how we take for granted and really don't know that much about the infrastructure that sustains our life. I just would like to invite callers to talk about that. What do you think? I mean, when you turn on the shower, literally, do you wonder where the water came from? Some of you may in fact do that, and good for you. That's good thinking. That is, Let us know what, maybe you have some questions about how this stuff works. Scott did the work. He did the research to find out how our infrastructure works, and he put it in a book for you to read, and you can ask him questions about it. Do you wonder how things work? How we get the electricity that that comes into our homes? How that whole internet thing happens? Maybe you are wondering about some of the technology that sustains our lives. All that's fair game this hour. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Facebook page. Leave a comment there, and we'll share it with the radio audience as well. So a lot of ways for you to connect with the program this morning. We're talking about the infrastructure that sustains our lives and how it all works and why it's important for us to know that. Why do we need to know about this stuff? Well, we'll be talking about that with Scott and with you for the rest of this hour. Again, that number 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of WPR. 23 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Here's a reminder, a special program note for later this morning. President Obama is going to be releasing the 30-day safety review of deep water drilling by the White House, and then he'll take questions about the Gulf oil spill and his administration's response to it. NPR's David Green will host the event. He'll be joined by Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, and Elizabeth Shogren, environmental correspondent for National Public Radio. This special will begin at 11:40 and end at about 1 o'clock. Listeners to Chapter a Day can hear the program this evening at 11 p.m., or they can go online at WPR.org/chapter. Again, we'll be carrying President Obama's remarks and press conference later this morning, starting at 11:40 here on the Ideas Network of WPR. This hour, we're talking with the author of the book, On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work, with Scott Hewler. And his award-winning radio work has been heard on All Things Considered, Day-to-Day, Marketplace, and The Splendid Table, among other places. He's the author of 6 books, and he is joining me by telephone. Now, telephone infrastructure, Scott, is something that I can actually claim to have some understanding of. So that would be one for me. I won't pretend to understand what happens when I press the lever and flush the toilet. I don't do plumbing. Let's go to the phones. We have some callers who want to join us, and we'll start with Jim in Madison. Jim, good morning.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Wonderful topic. I'm in the business that I believe your guest is in. I support the water and wastewater industry here in Wisconsin with equipment and technical experience and expertise, and trying to get communities to improve their infrastructure. And I guess my comment is probably one that he's made in his book multiple times over. We are so used to paying for things like internet and cell phones and cable, and we have no problem paying ridiculous amounts of money for those kinds of, I guess, useless utilities. Maybe not useless, but not as needed as water and sewer. And I think we just dramatically do not pay anywhere near the right amount for the value of the tap water and the sewer service that we are provided by the community. We take that buried infrastructure for granted. We expect it to be there, and we should pay a lot more for it. And I spend a lot of time trying to convince communities and other folks to invest more money in their buried infrastructure, but it's very hard politically to sometimes get folks to do that. And I'm just curious if that book that he has written mentions this.
John,
Scott,
your caller could not be more right. He is exactly right. One of the problems is that the infrastructure is just so infra. Infra means below. We don't see it. It runs so constantly and so well and so cheaply that people think it's free and they think it happens naturally. They just don't understand. When you talk to the people who do the electricity and the communications, they are justly proud of the 99%+ positive rate they have, that you almost never don't have service, right? And then if you drive away and you can't, your cell phone doesn't reach a tower, you are screaming, you're furious, right? Because how dare that
that cell phone not work. We're all that way. But the water people like to say, when was the last time your water service went out? Because they know that your answer will be, I don't ever remember that happening. And they consider themselves public health professionals, which is what they are. And so much is happening. So many people are doing so many things. John, you made the point, which was really great, right at the beginning of the show, where you said that the technology is almost logarithmic, that it's sort of, it starts and it's a certain way for a while, and then all of a sudden it races its way to a new level where it stays for a while, and then it races to level after level, and now those levels are coming so quickly in so many different ways that it's very hard for people to keep up, and they don't realize how safe their water is. They don't realize that they've taken, what, 150,000, 250,000 drinks of water in their lives, and the next time they get a waterborne illness will be the first. Now, Milwaukee actually had that cryptosporidium problem a few years ago that got an enormous amount of national publicity. Why did it get so much national publicity? Because that never happens. That's how rare it is that this one tiny problem that was solved, that was handled right, that everything, you know, once in a while you're going to have a problem. But that's how shocked we were, because nothing ever goes wrong. And it's so cheap. The if you think about that bottle of water that you bought at the convenience store a week ago, that you spent $2 for to get a pint of water, for that same $2, if you had turned on your tap, you would have got 600 gallons of water out of your kitchen tap or your bathtub tap. That's insanely inexpensive. We should be charging more for it, because if we charged more for it, not only could we maintain the systems better, but we would treat it as though it were worth more.
Well, you know, the one of the things, and I'll just relate a personal story before we take the next call. We moved out to we moved out to the country about 5 years ago. And when we lived in town, we were on the city sewer system, and we paid a sewer tax. It was part of our water bill. And, you know, you just expect it. Every month, you write the check or whatever. When we moved out to the country, we had a holding tank. And I'll tell you what. You become very conscious of your water use for all purposes when someone has to come every month and pump your tank, and he leaves behind a bill for $96. It can be a real shock when you find out how fast you fill up a 2,500-gallon holding tank. And you think about everything that goes in it. Well, I try not to think about it, but at least not at dinner time. But the idea is that, you know, we have no idea how much we use this stuff, how long we let the water run, for example, you know, how long the showers are that we take. Because we don't, there's a real disconnect, I think, is what you're communicating. There's a real disconnect between our use of these utilities and what the actual cost is.
John, you're exactly right, and that's a perfect example. I talked to the sewer, the collections superintendent for Raleigh, who was the guy who's in charge of the pipes that carry the sewage from our houses down to the wastewater treatment plant. And he worried about this. He worried about it seriously. He's a guy who grew up in one of the rural counties around Raleigh back when Central North Carolina was rural. And he talked about digging a hole every year and picking up the outhouse and moving it and putting it over the new hole and taking the dirt from the new hole and throw it into last year's hole, and that would cover things up, and that you had to put the outhouse hole where it wouldn't be anywhere near the well, and it certainly had to be lower than the well, and just these natural things that an 8-year-old would know and would have a conscious awareness of where his water comes from, what happens to the waste from his body and from his household, where your food waste goes. They probably would have had pigs and chickens. Now we just throw it into the magic truck, and then they drive away with it, and we have no concept of it. And that's really the fundamental question that I tried to address with On the Grid, was that I'm not so sure that I really have any answers for what we should be doing, although I definitely think we should be paying more taxes. But I wanted to say we should know how these systems work, because our lives are so easy and they are so constantly supported by these dozens of systems that make our lives so simple, and we should at least know they're out there, because we're going to have a lot of questions to answer about them over the coming years. And what you discovered is what everybody discovered, that the taxes come, and so we're like, oh, those bad people in the government, they're just taking my money.
Well, then they're using that money so that I can flush the toilet and never have to think about it for a minute, so that I can turn on the tap and drink fresh, clean water every day.
Well, I'll tell you what, if we privatized city utilities, as happens some places, you'd pretty soon find out what things really cost.
Absolutely. You'd find out what they cost, and you'd see all sorts of terrifying things. It used to be private water utilities, and as people have pointed out, it's pointed out constantly in research papers, that African Americans had twice the rate of typhoid as European Americans, because the private water companies, they wanted to go where people could pay a lot of money for water, and they didn't necessarily care to go into neighborhoods that was they were going to put lay down a lot of pipes and not make that much money. So they just didn't run the pipes there because they didn't care to. And so people who didn't have access to fresh water for any number of reasons got sick. And if it's privatized, well, then they've got their options. They can do what they wish. So you're exactly right. Privatizing, everybody thinks it would be such a great thing. Oh, there would be competition. Privatizing would not be a very good idea. You don't want to privatize your water. Your water belongs to everyone.
Let's go next to Russell in Madison. Russell, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, everyone. I was curious if your guest had any information about gray water systems.
Gray water systems, meaning reuse, water reuse? Yes,
exactly. That's
both on a municipal basis and on a local basis. Water reuse is one of the greatest ideas that people are talking about right now. For people who aren't familiar with it, water reuse systems in homes are systems that take water from your shower, say, or rainwater and things like that, and hold it in a tank and use it for things like flushing toilets, so that you're not using nice, fresh, treated, clean, potable water for something like that. And then it uses it also for irrigating your lawn, things like that, things where it's not going to be a health issue for you. Now, municipal systems take that on a much larger scale and take some of the water from the wastewater treatment plant and then repump it back up into the city for use in irrigation and things like that. Raleigh has put one in, for example. It has its own separate water pipes. It has its own separate water towers. It doesn't come in any kind of contact with the fresh water, and it's used for irrigating enormous situations like golf courses or university lawns and things like that. And naturally, this is a great thing. Raleigh, 2 years ago, suffered through a drought of biblical proportions. We were almost out of water, and this is one of the things that will resolve. Instead of taking 10 million gallons a day of our fresh treated water from our diminishing reservoir to water the lawns on the golf courses, you're taking water that's coming out of the wastewater plant and using it for that. It's a great thing. And yet the citizenry, many elements, stood up and complained because they felt that they were being asked to subsidize the water being used to water the golf courses. And people just so strongly mistrust anything that happens in government and anything that the government wants to do. And I think this is a terrible trend, because the government is us, obviously, but also, John, as you were saying, the money that the government takes to do these services is directly related to things that we used to do for ourselves, or sometimes now do for ourselves. A great example is the roadways. It used to be real simple. You were responsible for maintaining the roadway in front of your house, and the city would come to your house a few days a year, knock on the door, come on, it's road day for you, let's go. Get a shovel. You were responsible for a certain number of days per year of labor maintaining the roads in your city. Well, you could buy your way out of that if you wanted to, or down here you could send two slaves to do your work for you. Well, buying your way out of it, that's what we all do now, only we call it taxes. But instead of saying, thank goodness, I get to pay money, and I don't have to worry about how many inches of gravel and how many inches of different levels of asphalt need to go on a road that carries 35,000 cars a day. I'll let somebody else worry about that. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We say, how dare you take my money? And there's such an enormous, John, as you said, there's this disconnect between the services that we're getting and how they get there. We have no concept. It's unnatural, and in some ways, I would claim, immoral. I think we're responsible for knowing more.
Well, where I live, the main problem is snow in the wintertime. Somebody has to move it. And, you know, what if somebody came to your house to collect, to plow the street in front of your house? And if you didn't pay, they just didn't plow your part of the street. That's kind of facetious, but, you know, it's one of those what-if questions. Here's, I think Tom in Hudson has a great question. Let's go to him next. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. You know, when I was little, I spent a little bit of time in Denmark, and when we were there, my parents got me this terrific book called Why Does It Rain? And what I learned from this book was all about water infrastructure, and I had absolutely no idea, you know, as a six-year-old, how any of this stuff worked. But I'm thinking about my own kids today and how invisible infrastructure really is to them, and I think that I have to work very hard to help them be aware, and getting young people in front of this, I think, is an awfully important thing to do. With the kind of the green movement in progress, maybe this is a good time to dovetail these items and get this in front of our kids and make it a priority for young people.
Oh, I think that's a great point. You're exactly right. And one of the things, I have a five-year-old, and he just knew that when we heard a grinding noise or a big truck going by, that he should jump up from the breakfast table because Daddy was going to run out the door and go look at something and go talk to somebody. And he would come along, and we would watch, for example, we watched them grind off the asphalt on a road and then lay a new road. And it's not so important that he understands how they did it or the particulars, but it's really important for him to understand a road isn't just there. Somebody builds that road, and somebody puts it down, and they use a certain thing for a surface and not something else, and they decide to put it in a certain place and not in another place, and people are thinking about those things, and that's part of your world, and you should be aware of it. People have told me that they look at this book as an environment book, as a sort of an ecology book, that it's like a Peterson's Guide to the Infrastructure of the, you know, suburban America or something like that. And I'm very flattered by that because, in a way, that's exactly what it is. It's saying, what's surrounding you? What are you aware of? Just the way you like to know, is that a hickory or is that an oak? Is that, what kind of pine is that in my yard? Well, what kind of bird was that that's coming to the feeder today? I want to know because what's going on? Well, we should want to know the same thing. One of the favorite things that I learned and that I love to show people is that, you know, those mysterious hieroglyphics, those spray-painted hieroglyphics that show up on your street every now and then, dotted lines, dashed lines, diamonds, they're red, they're pink, they're blue. Those have actual, that's a specific code used by all the people in all the public works companies for what's underneath the ground. If somebody's going to dig, you'll see white marks where they're going to dig. Then the electric company people will come and they will put lines in red where the electric lines are buried. And orange means communication lines. Yellow means gas lines. Green means wastewater. Blue means potable water. And purple means water reuse, gray water, as our last caller was talking about. It was one of the most thrilling moments of my life when I realized that you can understand those crazy things that show up on the ground. You can understand what that means, and you can see what's there, what kind of valve. If you do just a small amount of decoding, you can learn so much. And as we all know, information is power, and if we understand what's going on down there, when our city councils or public utilities department come to us and say, we need money to do this, and here's what we think will happen if we don't do it, and here's what we think we'll get if we do it, if we're at least basically conscious of what's out there, we can respond to those requests sensibly.
We're talking about the infrastructure that supports our daily living and a new book that talks about that infrastructure called On the Grid, written by Scott Hewler. He's our guest this hour. You can join us by phone. A line just opened up for you at 800-642-1234. If you'd like to use an alternative technology, you can try email, talk@wpr.org, and I've got a couple of emails I'm going to get to in just a moment, or you can leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page, and we'll share that with the our guest and with the rest of the radio audience as well. A programming reminder coming up at 11:40 this morning. President Obama will be releasing the White House 30-day safety review of deepwater drilling, and then he'll take questions about the Gulf oil spill and his administration's response to this disaster. We'll broadcast NPR's coverage here on the Ideas Network starting at 11:40. If you're a regular listener to Chapter a Day, you can hear the program this evening at 11, or you can listen to it online at wpr.org/chapter. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Scott Hewler is my guest. He's the author of On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work. He's written 6 books. He's an award-winning radio journalist whose work has been heard on All Things Considered and day-to-day on National Public Radio and on Marketplace and Splendid Table on American Public Media, among other places. And he's with us today with this technology we call the telephone. And a lot of other people are, too. But first, I would like to get to a couple of these emails. Here's an interesting one from John in Milwaukee. And Scott, I don't know if this is a subject you can speak to, but we'll take a shot at it. John says, I live in Milwaukee and think it's tragic that a city this size doesn't have a subway system. What are the logistics involved in designing, installing, and running an effective subway system when a city doesn't have one and then decides they want one?
Well, he's right. I think that public transportation is a vital direction that we have to be going. You look at infrastructure as destiny. This is something you hear all the time right now among the infrastructure ad-I. Infrastructure is destiny. And to a certain degree, it's true. I think our infrastructure ourselves comes a little bit closer to it, that for years, you know, we, as you said early in the first minute of this show, we fell so deeply in love with the car that we forsook all others. And we're now, it took us, you know, 50 or 60 years to wreck all the wonderful public transportation we have had, and it will take us a long time to rebuild that. To put a subway system under a modern city is an unbelievably complicated undertaking. I spent a lot of time underground for this book. Raleigh, nothing's underground except sewer pipes, basically, and water pipes. I was in the stormwater system clambering around under there, and I popped up in a construction site where there had been a collapse, and I ended up talking to the city engineers there and saying, well, what are you going to have to do besides just dig the hole, you know, fix up this stormwater culvert and then repave it? And she started listing all the utilities she was going to have to deal with, the water and the telephones and the cable and the electric and the sewer and the gas, just because once you start digging, you never know what you're going to hit. Even no matter how good your records are and how good your graphical information system is, you just never really know what's under there. So imagine trying to dig up something big enough to put subway tunnels under. And it would be billions and billions of dollars. I still think it's a great idea, something like that. You know, a transportation system that doesn't mean you get caught in street traffic, which is exactly the goal of a transportation system, to provide an alternative to clogging up the roads. It's worth it. I think that the cities that make those investments will be the cities that emerge in the next centuries and beyond as the places people want to live. But it takes an enormous effort of political will and an enormous amount of money. And as my friend Eric Lamb said, those are the two things that constantly turn out in short supply. So I think it's a great idea. I'd vote for it if I lived there, but you, your caller, your emailer, and I would be part of the small minority of people who said, yes, this is the right way to go for the future.
Here's another email from Steve in Park Ridge, Illinois. Is there any hope of decentralizing our energy sources in the future, such as local windmills, solar cells, and coastal wave generators? This seems prudent from a resources perspective as well as national security.
I think there is. I think that that's slowly the direction that we're moving, and as your emailer says, that's prudent and sensible, and just every way that we can find to generate electricity that doesn't burn coal and knock the tops off of mountains or doesn't burn oil, and we don't even need to talk about what that means, as we can obviously see now, is an improvement. And the whole smart grid movement, and your listeners should know that everybody talks about the smart grid, but nobody really knows exactly what that means. It's kind of, you know, it's like Web 2.0, what everybody talks about. Well, it's the web, only it's better, right? It's the smart grid is the same thing. Well, it'll give you more control, and it'll allow you to both draw from the grid and pump out to the grid. So the idea would be that you've got your solar array on your roof, and when it's hot and you're not using
in your energy, you can sell it back to the power company at that moment. And if it's hot, lots of people will be running the air conditioners. So that'll be a moment when the energy is expensive, and so you're winning by selling to them. And then at night, you can buy nice cool, nice cheap energy when nobody's using it, and use that to wash your clothes. That's kind of the concept. We've got a long way to go to get there, but we'll get there, I think. And then that frees up the capacity for people to generate energy on their own property however they can. It might be hard to allow people to put windmills high enough to go above their trees in city situations, but we may get there too. I think that people are looking at everything, and I think the people in the electric utilities are just as motivated as the rest of us are, at least the people who I dealt with were. They make the point that the way an electric utility is now set up, it's a publicly held company responsible to its shareholders, and it makes its money by selling kilowatt hours of electricity. So then we come to them and say, we want you to help us encourage conservation. You can understand why they come back and say, well, okay, we'll do that, but what you're telling us is that you want us to sell less of our product. Please don't be surprised if then our product becomes more expensive because we still need to maintain our equipment and things like that. So we have to help the utilities come up with new models and a new way that everybody sort of partners into improving the situation. And we have to help them know that they need our help, too. Sometimes they resist that.
We've got the phone bank is full, so I would like to try to get to all of these calls before the top of the hour. Hopefully we can all be succinct, more succinct than the host usually is anyway. We'll go to Mike in Appleton next.
Yeah, a couple of comments. I've lived many years overseas in many different countries, and we have absolutely no appreciation for the fantastic infrastructure that we have. You know, we flip a switch, the lights go on, turn on the tap, and there's water. In most of these countries, you know, that's wishful thinking. And maybe, you know, for city planners or tax collectors, maybe the way to educate the public is send them on a one-week vacation to some of these countries, and I think they'll come through very quickly. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
I couldn't agree with that more. I traveled, and I was in Nepal one night, and I was sitting at a restaurant, and suddenly the lights went out. And I just marveled at how sort of resourceful these people were. They quickly brought out candles, put candles on everybody's table, and they were cooking with gas. And I thought, how did they respond so quickly? And, of course, I was stupid. It didn't hit me until much later that it was just no electricity night in that part of the city. The electricity goes out at 7 p.m. every Tuesday. And, you know, it's rolling blackouts because they only have a certain amount of power, and so they parse it out. And they just live without. They live in a very different way, and they appreciate the power, and you use it when you've got it, and then you live without it when you don't. And as your caller said, we don't have any idea how good we have it. And I couldn't agree more that getting out and looking at how the rest of the world lives would really open up a lot of people's eyes and would make them appreciate more. I've had people talk to me about whether municipal water service is really a good thing or a bad thing. Maybe it would be better if everybody was sort of responsible for their own water. And you just hold your head in your hands. You think there are a billion people in this world who would probably sacrifice a limb to give their children access to the fresh water that people will come up to me and with a straight face say we would be better off without. I can't imagine that.
Yeah. Let's go to Bill in Elm Grove next. Bill, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I have a comment. A few years ago, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal by a medical person, and it took about half a page, and it was relating about how medical profession and medical science has expanded the lengthened the life of humans. I mentioned surgery and prescriptions and vaccines. And within a few days, a civil engineer responded with about a three-paragraph letter saying, well, all of that is fine, but it would be all redundant if it wouldn't have been for the civil engineers putting in the sanitation system and preventing typhoid, et cetera.
That's exactly right. The famous Dr. Snow in England, who figured out that cholera that was spreading by a particular pump in London. He made what's called the first graphical information systems map, where he mapped the houses where the disease was, and then he put the pumps on the map, and then he found that all of the diseases were gathered around a certain pump, and he realized that the water from that pump that was coming out of that pump was being polluted by sewage from, you know, from the septic systems that people had buried under their houses. I mean, it's unimaginable the way people lived even 100 or 150 years ago. And he broke the pump handle off, famously, and then the epidemic ceased. And that's exactly right. I think that there was a survey of the greatest invention in the last 200 years, and by, you know, the flush toilet lapped the field. It was by far the greatest invention, the modern sanitation. Modern sanitation is what makes our lives possible.
Jeff in Superior, you'll be next. Good morning, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I love this book. It sounds like a very interesting book to raise the consciousness of people. I was at a town hall meeting where Senator Feingold was in Grantsburg recently, and I tried to get him to comment on this topic because I really think we need a vision for the future, one that involves population control and people not having so many kids and controlling the number of people we have on this planet. You know, Lake Superior has 20% of the world's fresh water, and who knows what our future will be when we double our population or whatever. I really appreciate this topic. I hope it's available in the public libraries around the state.
Well, I hope so, too. It's certainly available in bookstores now. I do hope that the libraries are buying it and are looking at this. And you just couldn't be more right that we need to look at all of these resources, whether it's the coal and the oil that we're burning or whether it's the water that we're using. Don't forget, before water distribution, the average person used 3 to 5 gallons of water per day. Now the average American uses between 100 and 150 gallons of water every day. And that's in-home use. That's nothing compared with the water that we get, you know, used through agriculture or raising beef or things like that. But we use all of this water, and we really don't understand how valuable it is, and we don't understand how much of it we could do without, and what a better job we could be doing managing this resource. And I wanted to point out that I worked really hard in this book. I didn't want to be Chicken Little, and I didn't want to be Al Gore saying, if we don't screw in curly light bulbs tomorrow, the ice sheet's going to slide off Greenland like snow off a pitched roof, and we're going to drown tomorrow. And I didn't want to sound like Dick Cheney saying, shut up and keep driving. You know, keep buying your gas and just do what you're doing. I wanted to just say, these systems are out there. Be aware, be alert, understand them, so that when the debates come up, you can respond in a alert manner. Rather than, I'm not trying to tell you the answers. Now, again, by the end, I think my true colors showed, because the last chapter of this book is an overt love letter to paying taxes and a claim that we need to be paying more taxes. So I don't think there's that many. I think that there's a lot of people who will dismiss me on that ground, on those grounds.
Well, it's probably one of those situations where you can pay now or you can pay later, but you're going to pay.
Absolutely. Or if you don't want to pay, you can just save the whole thing by going to Home Depot or Lowe's and spending $10 and buy yourself a hard hat and wear it, because it's going to come down on your head. But if that's what you want to spend your money on, you're better off that way.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a website or anything you could direct us to for more information on this?
Absolutely. ScottHuler.com. My name, ScottHuler.com, will take you directly to not just talk about the book, but I've tried to put on the website links to interesting infrastructure sites, stuff that I found on the all over the Internet to tell you about these systems. There's a great site that links you to mountaintop removal coal mining. If you put in your zip code, it'll tell you which mountains are being destroyed so that you could leave your computer on all night and stuff like that. And anything that makes us more aware of what's happening is good. So I'd love for people to start at ScottHuler.com.
ScottHuler.com. I've got a list of questions here that well, we sacrificed a forest this morning so I could print that, but we're not going to get to them all. I would like to talk at length about this subject. It just hasn't been that long since we were practically drowning in our own waste in New York City and things like that, and we really do take this stuff for granted at our own peril, probably.
Right. Well, and it's so much of it is so new that Raleigh got its first wastewater treatment plant in 1957. So don't, when I was thinking no wastewater treatment plant, I'm thinking covered wagons, perukes, guys in pantaloons. No, I should be thinking mom's wedding. Do you know? That's staggering to me how recent it is. And we act like it's been our birthright since the dawn of time. And I would love to increase awareness, and that's the goal of this book.
Scott Hueller, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate the conversation.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Again, the name of the book is On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and the Systems That Make Our World Work, published by Rodale Press. You can find out more about Scott's work at scotthueller.com. If you'd like to listen to this program again, you can go to WPR.org, go to the Kathleen Dunn page, and click on today's program. You should be able to hear it. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, on-air production by Erica Janik. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of WPR.